This is a really big social issue, and I think it comes down to family units, it comes down to neighbourhoods, community, connection.
Welcome to another edition of Eye on the Peninsula this Tuesday, the 16th of August, with Michelle from Seniorpreneurs discussing the social issues around the over 50s age group being unemployed. More on that story a little later. Good afternoon, I'm Deborah Maher, standing in for Piers Cunningham, broadcasting from the RPPFM studios in Mornington. Heading up today's program, we cover more debate around the seawall and steps at Sorrento with Associate Professor from Deakin University. What's happening at Bulloora House to celebrate 100 years of the Tallis family ownership? We have the final story in a four-part series that uncovers the good work people do in our local communities. This time we discover the work the Mornington Community Information and Support Centre does to help our disadvantaged. And a local choir is off to Carnegie Hall in New York to perform. But first, a new code of conduct to amend the Local Government Act of 1989 required local councillors to sign the amendment in a specified time. That deadline has passed, with one Frankston councillor, Daryl Taylor, caught up in the state government mandate date of July 4th. In the studio, I have Councillor Taylor to put the record straight. Good morning, Daryl. Great to have you back on Eye on the Peninsula.
Yeah, good morning, Deb. How are you?
Well, thank you. Now, the amended code set down by the state government discourages councillors from making personal attacks on each other and bad behaviour. But it's turned out to be a very perplexed and long-winded exercise with you and the Frankston City Council facing a non-compliance of the amendment, which could lead to councillors being stood down.
That's
but
right.
First, for the benefit of our listeners, explain how this nonsensical dispute came about with you and the Frankston City Council.
Well, as you've alluded to in your editorial, the government amended the Local Government Act to bring in measures to tighten up councils' behaviour. It also allowed a little bit more power for mayors to allow control of councils' behaviour. And it also set out an internal resolution process. So the amendments in the Act I agreed with, and they were well needed. But what they also did was, when the amendments were passed in Parliament, they put in an Act 76C of the Act, which stipulated that councils must update their code of conducts by the 1st of September to reflect what's in the Act. And there was a certain process that had to be followed to do that, and that was, one, to hold a meeting to amend their code of conduct to bring in the internal resolution processes and what have you in the Act. Then once that was adopted at a meeting, they had 30 days in which to sign, acknowledge and sign that they've have read and acknowledged the code of conduct, and it had to be done in front of the CEO. Now, a number of councils and individual councillors have followed the process somewhat, but there's been some confusion around the signature. Some councils have signed it, but not in front of the CEO. Some councils have signed it in front of the CEO, but not within a 30-day period. Some councillors haven't signed it at all. So there's a number of scenarios affecting numerous councils, probably up to 200 councillors, that will say that on the 1st of September, because you haven't followed the process stipulated in the Local Government Act, you may be disqualified as a councillor.
Was there a misunderstanding then with the guidelines set down by the Local Government Investigations and Compliance Inspectorate? Where's the misunderstanding come from?
Well, I think the misunderstanding comes from two things. One was the requirement leading up to the 1st of September, and the other was the understanding that the amendment that came in, the 2015 Local Government Amendment Bill, was to come into effect on the 1st of September. So I think administrators, being the CEOs and administrators of councils, may have been confused around, are the requirements to adhere and acknowledge to the code of conduct designed for the election coming up? So to be a councillor, once you're elected, you must take oath of office. So what the government intends in the new updated Act is that you take oath of office, and at the same time you acknowledge that you'll abide by the code of conduct. And when you sign an oath of office, you also sign the acknowledgement of the code of conduct and the conduct of a councillor. So there must have been a bit of confusion around the processes leading up to the 1st of September and what was intended after the elections that are coming up in October.
So do you think by signing the revised Code of Conduct under the Local Government Act of 1989 will shut down debate and transparency among councillors? And has there been bad behaviour amongst councillors at Frankston City Council?
There has been a number of reports in Frankston City Council around individual councillors' behaviour, and there was one recently, a Code of Conduct hearing recently, where a councillor had to apologise for behaviour. But generally councils, Frankston Council's generally very, very well behaved. Councils are essentially a very robust environment. So I don't think the Code of Conduct should be designed to shut down debate and shut down councils' ability to represent their community. But at the same time, a Code of Conduct can be used for petty point scoring purposes or petty political point scoring. That needs to be pulled in, which is what the Act is attempting to do. But I think one of the important elements is that under the Act, there is no remedy provision. So if a councillor refuses to sign the Code of Conduct, that is worthy of disqualification.
What do you mean by disqualification?
Well, it means that you no longer hold the qualification to hold office. It means that you haven't complied with the provisions of the Act that says that you are qualified to be a councillor. Essentially is a sacking. They are essentially taking away your power as a councillor.
How are we going to fix this? What next? Now, there was an article written in The Age yesterday that highlighted what is actually going on, but there could be some jumping the gun there as well. Go through that.
There's been numerous debate and conjecture of what's going to happen. I believe the minister made a statement yesterday saying that they're looking at the matter and they want to resolve it as quickly as possible. There's a number of scenarios. They can go through with the disqualification under the Act. That would mean that up to 13 councils would require administrators. That could affect up to 200 councillors. That disqualification would not be as any fault of their own. It would be through the fault of a confusion by the administration of implementation of the Act itself or the intendants of the Act. They could bring an amendment to give some extension of time to conform with the requirements of the Act. You know, I think there should be a mechanism of remedy in the Act. So therefore, if you haven't signed within 30 days in front of the CA, you must be given opportunity to give reason why you haven't done this and bring it in for those who refuse to sign the Code of Conduct, then that would disqualify you. The only other way to really clean it up is to make sure that the Code of Conduct is signed at the same meeting when you take oath of office, and that will resolve any issues around the process. I think the government needs to, for clarity, sort it out very quickly. There's people with building permits, there's a lot of policies and budgetary implications, there's tenders, there'll be a lot of tenders out there for roadworks, all sorts of works that need to be approved. So this could affect tens of millions of dollars of productivity that needs to be resolved quickly. I think given that this is an election year, councils go into caretaker mode on the 21st of September. Standing down 200 councillors on the 1st of September to go through all the legislative requirements to try and get administrators in by the 21st of September would be a futile exercise.
Now, with the Frankston City Council, the councillors there, are they really afraid and scared of what could be?
We're not afraid or scared. This does impact all councils at Frankston City Council. So if the government goes ahead, all of Frankston City Councils will be stood down. We're just uncertain. We need to know, A, will we be stood down, and B, if we can run again as a councillor. So if they wish to stand us down the 1st of September, understanding that there's been a mistake in the process, that's fine. Then we can move ahead with preparing for the next election. If we can't run again, then obviously we'll be concerned about making sure that it's quite clear that it's through no fault of our own, so it doesn't give us any discredit or any smear on your reputation as such.
Thanks so much, Daryl, for being on Eye on the Peninsula again, and we'll catch up a little bit later down the track to see how this has all panned out.
Yeah, it's my pleasure, Deb. I'm always happy to come on and have a chat. Thank you.
The Sorrento timber seawall was constructed on this Sorrento foreshore over 100 years ago and requires regular maintenance. It's now starting to fail. We speak with Ursula de Jong, Associate Professor for the School of Architecture and Built Environments at Deakin University, as well as the President of the Nepean Conservation Group, regarding this issue.
The Nepean Conservation Group was formed in 1973. Our vision is for people to understand and appreciate the natural, cultural and built heritage that contributes to the sense of place of the Nepean Peninsula in order to actually protect and conserve the amenity and enhance the character of the
The Nepean Conservation Group got involved with the seawall project at the beginning of the community consultation.
The first time we got involved in it was in a meeting that was called the information meeting in July 2015, where state government, with local government, and a few representatives of the community groups went along to that. Then not much was heard anymore from that. And in February this year, so 2016, somebody in the audience asked a question at the NCG AGM. We followed up from there to discover that some decisions had been made and no more input was invited from the community. As a conservation group, we believe that no full community consultation was undertaken at any time, really.
The Department of Environment, Land, Water and Planning believe that the steps should be replaced, and the Nepean Conservation Group agree that they have eroded over time. However, the Nepean Conservation have different views regarding the design.
DELP, who's the department, based their decision on what they believe the community wanted, as far as we can understand. The seawall itself was no longer stable and needed replacing, so there's no issue about that. We all agree on that. But we think the proposed seawall is not a replacement of what was actually there, and they're not appropriate in terms of the environment, in terms of sensitivity to place, or even from a safety perspective. We don't think the alternatives have been fully explored. A rock wall could have been a better interface, and the timber pylons could have been considered more carefully.
As the president of the Nepean Conservation Group, what are your major concerns?
The conservation group is particularly concerned about the ecology of the seagrasses and the sea meadows, for example, that have not been considered. And we think the impact's critical. So DELP actually told us that we're only going to lose 9%, but we think that's a significant portion of the seagrass meadows. As well, you know, this is a breeding place for fish and a place where lots of birds come with their young. Also a place where families come to see their species in a natural environment.
The Sorrento Timber Seawall assists in keeping the landscape a natural environment, as well as being as part of the landscape that makes Sorrento so popular to both locals and tourists.
We believe we, the conservation group and the community, the broader community as well as the government, have kind of got custodianship of this place and are trying to ensure that people can enjoy the natural place for decades to come.
Mrs. Yong has been quoted saying that she believes that the steps are the steps that lead to nowhere. And we ask her why she believes this.
They are a step to nowhere. They don't actually lead anywhere. People want to walk down these steps, and they're not actually steps. It's a step seawall. And depending on the tide, they're going to end up in the water. So we think it's quite dangerous, actually. And seagrass beds, if you look at it from that side, are very fragile. They're not a playground. They get uprooted at various times and in different seasons, but they don't need humans to increase the risk. So I guess that's where the thought came from.
More people refer to this project as steps, but Ms. De Jong says...
They're not actually a set of steps, but a stepped concrete sea wall on a huge scale.
In the opinion of the Nepean Conservation Group, what are some of the disadvantages with this particular project?
I've named some of the disadvantages, particularly, I guess, in terms of safety, the impact they're going to actually have on the environment. And we're also concerned about longevity. We haven't seen reports that give us comfort that that will all be okay.
With the disadvantages you said, do you think this project should continue to be under construction?
Given the way it is, we wrote to them a couple of months ago and said, no, they should halt the project and just see where we're going. But I think they should really reconsider what we've got there and take on board some of the issues that the communities have now raised with them. We haven't got any satisfactory answers from them at this stage at all, so I think that conversation needs to keep going.
It has been suggested this will be the place for families to spend time with each other in Sorrento.
We kind of think there's lots of places to do that along the sandy foreshore and the beach, or even in the grassy areas just behind, set back from the path. So we're not sure that it will be a great place in the end. Got, you know, the possibility of skateboarders, which no one has thought about, and that pastime doesn't mix well with families. And they're not a safe playground, in inverted commas. You know, they're going to have slippery surfaces when wet, whether it's the rain, the sea, algae, bird droppings. And we've been told high-pressure hoses are going to be used to clean them. And we're wondering who's going to pay for that and what impact will that have on the environment. The other issue that the Port Phillip Conservation Group raised was disability access, which is a major issue. And I guess others have also raised the issue of being, you know, a prime site for litter and probably a great place for graffiti artists. They can't write on sand.
In regard to the high-pressure hose, would litter and graffiti mentioned end up in the ocean?
Well, I'm presuming that's where it would go, unless they had some other way of collecting it. So we're concerned what chemicals they would use, you know, with the high-pressure hose to get some of the algae off and to stop them forming again, to stop the slipperiness. And certainly, yes, I don't know what chemicals you need to remove graffiti. And again, who picks up the bill? I think the state government's paying for the wall, but the Shire, I think, is being asked to pick up the bill on maintenance and caring for it. So I don't think that's all been thought through.
In ending our discussion, Ms. De Jong left us with 3 points.
First one is the community consultation processes need to be reconsidered so that the voices of the community are heard, listened to, and some action is actually taken. Secondly, that an environmental impact study should be undertaken, and that its findings are actually reported, reviewed, and acted upon. And the third thing, really, that the heritage significance of the historic coastal town of Taranto should be considered. So this step seawall is not in keeping with, I guess, the sense of place, the character of this place, not sensitive to the coastal landscape, that significantly impacts on the fragile ecology. I guess, contrarily, the NCG was told that the Mornington Peninsula Shire will employ a placemaking expert once the seawall's completed. And I kind of think this is back-to-front thinking. We should be doing that first, not waiting till the end.
That was Ursula De Jong, Associate Professor of the School of Architecture and Built Environments at Deakin University. To hear views on this issue from Chris Padovani, Regional Manager at the Department of Environment, Land, Water and Planning, and Jenny Wharf, Secretary of the Port Phillip Conservation Council, head to the Eye on the Peninsula page on the RPPFM website and listen to the podcast on the 2nd and 9th of August 2016. Thank you to Kiara Kemp for compiling that report. Up now, are you a seniorpreneur? And later, a concert at Ballura House and Garden for lovers of fine music to celebrate the centenary of the Tallis family ownership. Our concerns is that we are living longer, and some say our superannuation will not suffice in our old age. It's then likely most of us will need to continue to work well over the age of 65. Michelle Homer, an advisor to Seniorpreneur, explains the role Seniorpreneur play for people over the age of 50 who want to continue to work. I'll take up the story with Michelle, but first, I'd like to play a quick comment member for Flinders and the new Minister for Industry, Innovation and Science, Greg Hunt, made on Eye the Peninsula a couple of weeks ago regarding the 50 age group in paid employment, introduced by presenter Piers Cunningham.
People over the age of 50 are having trouble getting employment. What plans are in place to incentivise employers to employ people over 50?
One of the things we're looking at is this notion of lifetime employment, because with people living longer, they want to work longer. The idea of being retired for 40 years actually works for some people, but for most people they're saying, hang on, I want to the satisfaction and the sense of purpose from work. So what we have is the incentives for employing older workers and retraining and taking them up. You know, we're working on both sides, both the employers and the employee sides, the training programs, but also the incentives for older workers. In particular, of course, you know, those skill sets, it's not about being out of date at all. You have people who just continue to be able to contribute. Sometimes where it's physical labour, they might need to move out of the more physical roles. Experience isn't just a word, it's a capacity to deliver in the workplace. We want people to have the opportunity and the option, but not the obligation, to work, you know, as long as they want to work.
Now Michelle talks about seniorpreneurs.
The role of seniorpreneurs, so it's a not-for-profit foundation. Really, the idea is to gain some momentum for people over 50 who are really keen to still be engaged in the workforce, either through business, starting up businesses themselves, or to work, whether it's on a contract basis or in full-time employment. The key sort of focus of seniorpreneurs is it's a place of hope, I guess, validation for you've got skills, experience, capability. What are my choices? So it's to answer that question, what are my choices?
Why the magic number of 50? Why not 45, 48? Considering the new 50 is 40.
Yes, yeah. Well, you kind of got to go somewhere. You have to, like, because of the name, it's seniorpreneurs. In reality, we have people who are 50, 60 who say they don't even relate to that name, and that's understandable. But the name gets attention, and the idea is that it's really part of the experience economy. So I'm 41. And I very much relate to the ethos and the philosophy behind seniorpreneurs, which is, you know, being engaged in the workforce for whole of life. 50 is really more, I guess, what government uses, what, you know, insurance company uses. It's just what's, I guess, understandable out in the marketplace.
Is the government doing enough to support and educate employers to employ over 50s in the workplace?
Yes and no. I think no, because there's not enough, I guess, awareness, marketing around all the kinds of initiatives and things like that that they are actually offering. More needs to be done. And I think around the mentoring, the contracting, even senior internships, there's so many things that could be being done. Most initiatives and community funding and programs are all aimed at youth, and that's the reality. So a lot more to be done, but people have got to speak up.
The Restart program is an Australian government wage subsidy that encourages businesses to employ mature aged workers. To receive this wage subsidy, an employer needs to take on employees who are 50 years of age or older. Is this program working?
I think so. I think if you look through the media, and certainly the, you know, the media that I read, I think there is a shift in attitude and looking at skills and capabilities differently. Certainly when you look at length of tenure and likelihood of someone staying in a role as well, there's a lot of, you know, things that can be leveraged from people who are willing to commit to a position, stay in a position and learn it well. Bearing in mind that seniorpreneurs is very much around entrepreneurship and innovation too. So how can I create employment for myself, and what are my options to get involved in business from using my experience in creative and innovative ways, not just through a standard employment process, because things are changing.
I think that's where it's all headed, because we'll have to look at what niche markets are out there for the over 50s. Mm. But then also discrimination comes into it with employers not wanting to employ over 50s. It becomes a little bit of a, well, I know why you didn't employ me because I'm over that age. And is it because they want more pay, maybe they're overqualified, the perception is that people over 50 are a bit slower maybe, they're not computer savvy?
There's any number of reasons why an employer might not choose someone. So if you've got the right skills for the role and you can show that you're committed to the role and you're keen to be involved in that organisation and all the things you add, you should, by right, have the same opportunity as anyone else. I think it's a lot to do with attitude as well and approach. Certainly that stigma is there across the board in all kinds of ways for all kinds of people, and it's something that has to be dealt with and managed.
The Victorian government is keen to take up major business hubs away from one central area. Would that be part of the solution to encourage more business and industry on the Mornington Peninsula to create more job opportunities for people over 50?
Absolutely. And I think that's for all people on the peninsula. I think that we definitely need some infrastructure, some industry, an injection of that down here that's appropriate, though, to, you know, our green wedge zones and all those sorts of things. So I know that there's going to be some development and growth in tourism. What else can we do in Frankston?
One of the areas Seniorpreneur would like to offer is an area where people can use a shared working space. What advice can you give to those in the 50s plus age group who want to work?
One thing we're trying to get is to make sure that there is co-working spaces for people to get together and that they're appropriate for everyone, so that people, no matter if they're 70 or they're 15, if they want to come in and want to get involved and engaged in the workforce and see what everyone else is doing, learn some more skills, but to collaborate and work together, what's working elsewhere, what's working for others. So I think that's actually quite a significant piece of this, is for people to have somewhere they can come together that's not just chit chat, but that's actually how can we help each other to gain employment, how can we perhaps start some businesses together, what can we do together to market ourselves, to get our resumes up to speak. Do we have a business idea? Is it an opportunity? What could we do together between us to get this off the ground or to test it? Collaboration is enormously important. Certainly, making sure that your CV and resume is relevant to the role that you are applying for.
I also have heard too on your resume, we know that you don't have to put your age anymore. Do we put we did VCE at a certain year, because then they can work back and think, well, I know how old that person is.
I think in all honesty, recruiters don't actually have the time to be sitting there doing math on things. I think that's the reality. That's the reality I see and that I experience, is that truly this is very much about a risk mitigation process. Is, does this person have the capabilities that I need? Is it written in a language that I can see will be understood by the employer? Does it make sense to them? Can they see exactly how that person will fit? If someone's looking to employ me, they're looking to see how I'm going to generate revenue and growth for them, full stop. How am I going to fit into their culture? How am I going to create value? So no longer do we go into roles just to do a job and go home. The economy's not like that. It's very much about, what does this person add above and beyond that the next person's not going to? And that's where this entrepreneurship piece comes in, is thinking more creatively about how your skills can be used.
So with dates and everything, you wouldn't even put dates?
I wouldn't. That's not relevant and certainly can't be asked for.
Other concerns associated with the over 50s age group not able to find employment is depression, mental health issues, social stigma and isolation. What's the government doing?
This is a really big social issue, and I think it comes down to family units, it comes down to neighbourhoods, community, connection, and that really, you know, to share something with you, if I'm feeling a bit tired, flat, down, low, I know I have this thing in my head that's called a helper's high, which is I just go and help someone. If we've got opportunities to give to others, to feel useful and productive, that the benefits to our psychological and emotional well-being are enormous. So if there was something that government had to do, and that's not an approach that really sits with me well, it's more about what can we all do, all of us, to take responsibility for looking after each other in communities and families. I think that that would be getting opportunities where people can use their skills, engage with others and support each other. And that's why I like entrepreneurship. That's why I'm interested in collaboration and the shared economy, as well as the experience economy.
What do you do if you are interested in finding out more about Seniorpreneur?
Visit the website, which is www.seniorpreneurs.org.au. Certainly a colleague of mine, Bambi Price, if you search her name, you will find it. And go on there and register, become a member. It's free to do that. And we really want to drive those numbers up, Devra, so that we can show that there is interest in this as well and make it visible and get some attention to get some, you know, projects off the ground, some collaboration, co-working spaces.
Those details again, seniorpreneur.org.au. Next, the Mornington Community Information and Support Centre and their volunteers. And shortly after, the Mornington Peninsula Chorale. Off to New York. Over the past 3 weeks, Eye on the Peninsula has uncovered three of many volunteer groups and organisations on the peninsula that give their time to make a difference in people's lives less fortunate than us. For the final story in the four-part series, the Mornington Community Information and Support Centre is our chosen organisation this week that is run by a group of generous volunteers. President of the Support Centre, John Riddle, joins me for a one-to-one discussion about this very important organisation and their role within our community.
The Mornington Community Information and Support Centre, it's a bit of a mouthful, but it explains exactly what we do. We're here in Mornington for the community, and we provide information and support. My name's John Riddle, and I'm currently the president of the committee and very much involved in the centre.
How long has it been going for, do you know?
To the best of my knowledge, we're about year 27, and we have some volunteers there who have been there for that full time.
So what sort of services do you do for the wider community down here on the Mornington Peninsula?
The support comes in many ways. We do give out food vouchers, and we have a pantry. Anything of that nature is generally determined by a confidential private interview with a client who comes along and asks for assistance.
Can that be family, singles, anybody?
Could be family, a lot of singles, unfortunately, younger ones. It comes from the full range. And We are looking after, in fact, last year we looked after 6,193 families and single people in our emergency relief program.
What other services does the Mornington Community Information and Support Centre offer?
Over the last few years, we've introduced a meals program where a three-course meal is made available for those who would like to come along. We have been assisted by, in all our programs, by the churches. The churches here in Mornington and the area around here are tremendous in supporting us.
Now, John, do you see an increase every year of people who need the services such as meals and support on the peninsula?
It goes up and down. It is seasonal. On occasions, it depends on payments from the federal government through Centrelink. But it is increasing, and we're starting to find more homeless. And we are aware of a number of homeless here, actually in Mornington, who are sleeping under the bushes on the foreshore.
It tends to be hidden. It's not a lot of...
Very hidden.
Yes. And why do you think that is?
Because people are, you know, they're proud. You know, they don't want to show the general public that they are in difficulties. One reason why I like to promote and like to be involved in spreading the word is to get the message out to the wider community that we are there. We are a resource to be used, and we would hope that they come along to us before it gets insurmountable. That way we can help them, and probably through ways that they didn't think about.
And who supports the services you offer, John?
We get support throughout the community. Finances are covered through federal, state and the council. Council are very excellent in supporting us, along with an annual amount of money, as well as the building that we have there in 320 Main Street is owned by the council and maintained by them. But the churches, regularly they deliver food for our pantry, and also those that are not quite as active in that particular area, they give us monetary donations as well.
Why do you think there is an increase in homelessness? Is it the government not supporting enough, or is it because of the increase of people moving down on the peninsula? Is it the cost of housing? What is it?
All of that. What I find so sad are younger people in their teens who are couch surfing on the street. They can't live with their parents for one reason or another. It is a social problem that we have at the moment. And those young people are at risk. And we respond very quickly when somebody of that nature comes in.
What's one of the rewards of the job at the centre?
And I love getting a first timer. When that person comes to the front door and they're so apprehensive about, they don't know what they're going to get. And so we can nurture them through the system and take a few shortcuts because they don't want to deal with the bureaucracy or the paperwork or anything of that nature. So we have a confidential interview with them. The only record that we keep is a case sheet that is on record, of course, and it's kept very secure.
And do you offer counselling?
Oh, yes. That's all part of it. And a lot of people who come in, they want a friendly ear, just somebody who will listen to them. They know that we're there to help them.
We know that you could not exist without volunteers.
Volunteers are enormously important. In fact, without them, we just could not exist. We do have paid staff, but the bulk of the personnel there are volunteers. And our entire committee of management is made up of volunteers with specialised skills as well. So we're fortunate there. What we do is enormous. Within our 320 Main Street, we have about 47 volunteers. 35 of those are trained, including myself, to interview. But overall, because of the many things that we do, we probably have about 150 volunteers. And we are desperately short. Now it is cold. People have sickness. In our age group, we like to go north for the winter. I would ask if anyone is interested and they think they want to get out and see what it's all about. Yes, come along, see what we do.
How many hours do you think they would need to put in, say, per week?
We generally expect volunteers to be there on a weekly basis, and they would do a half-day shift, 4 hours. We have other outlets as well. We have our food program volunteers. Second Bite has taken off, and every Thursday morning at St Mark's Church, up to 80 or 100 people come along for help.
The Mornington Community Information and Support Centre is attached to the Mornington Tourist Office. John says we must get out more and explore our own backyard.
It is a lighter part of what we do, and it's great. You'd find most locals don't know the detail of what the peninsula is all about, but yeah, we do, and there are little pockets there tucked away in the hills that are real gems.
So even our locals need to get to the Mornington Tourist Information Centre.
They need
and have
to just go. They just need to go out and discover their own backyard.
And some final words. So, John, if anybody does want a little bit of help or knows somebody who does need help, who can they go to? Who can they contact?
There's one phone number. It's very straightforward. 5975 1644.
And whereabouts are you in Mornington?
At 320 Main Street, Mornington.
Thank you to all our guests over the past 4 weeks who have contributed to this series about work volunteers who make a difference to people's lives. And it's worth mentioning, everyone at RPPFN radio station here in Mornington are volunteers also. To bring you a wide variety of programs including local news, sports, music and entertainment. Stay tuned now for details of a momentous concert to be performed at the historical Bloora House and Gardens in Mornington. Just down the road is an establishment that sits proud off Tallis Drive. Since Bloora House and Garden was built in 1863, the historical precinct has been delighting music lovers and the like for well over 100 years. This year marks a centenary of the Tallis family ownership. To celebrate this milestone, a sparkling musical mashup simply titled 1916 will be played out at the John Tallis Pavilion at Bloora House and Garden this month. I chat to the creator of the performance, Mr. Bruce Raggett, about this exciting event and the history surrounding this charming property in Mornington.
Bloora was built around about 1863, and it's an outstanding Victorian home with a wonderful colonnaded front, and it sits in the middle of a beautiful garden in the middle of Mornington. It passed through several owners before it was purchased in 1916 by Sir George Tallis and his wife, Lady Tallis, and they used it as their summer retreat. They had a very large mansion in Toorak, which has since been demolished, called Grosvenor, and lives on in a street that bears its name. But Bloora, fortunately, became an historic museum, really. And when Sir George passed away in 1948, he left it to his youngest son, John. And John lived there until 1996, when he himself passed away. And it was John's wish that the people of Victoria would enjoy the house, that it would be a reminder of a past time and an artistic retreat, because John himself was a musician, as a fine pianist and composer, and so he wanted to use his bequest to maintain the property, but also to make it a place where artists could come and perform. So it's a wonderful, wonderful legacy.
What sort of a man do you think Sir George Tallis was?
Well, Sir George came from Ireland. He came to Melbourne when he was around about 17, I think. And he came with two letters of introduction, one for a newspaper and one for the theatrical impresario, J.C. Williamson. And he decided to work for J.C. Williamson. And he was a quiet, very organised, very methodical person, a very good man, a very well-loved man. But he made theatre his life, and yet he doesn't seem to have been an extraordinarily theatrical person himself. But he earned the respect of the company. Above all, of course, J.C. Williamson, who promoted him up through the company. And then when J.C. Williamson himself passed away, Sir George Tallis, as he would become, became the big boss, and he transformed the company into one of the world's leading theatrical companies.
So who was J.C. Williamson, and what relationship then did he have to Sir George? They must have had a lot in common, even though Sir George wasn't a performer as such.
J.C. Williamson was actually an actor. He was an American. He came to Australia and as a performer, and I'm not quite sure why he decided to move into the theatrical management business, but he did. They own the Princess's Theatre in Spring Street and also Her Majesty's.
What do you think Sir George would think of the performing arts these days? Do you think he'd agree with what's going on, especially on the political stage?
Certainly a very different time in preparation for the performances that I'm doing at Ballura. I've been looking, of course, at the repertoire that J.C. Williamson did 100 years ago, and, of course, it's very different tastes. J.C. Williamson was presenting at the time with popular theatre. It wasn't highbrow, although we might think of it as highbrow now. But J.C. Williamson had tours with Dame Nellie Melba, and Sir George himself had a very close relationship with Dame Nellie, and Dame Nellie used to come and stay at Ballura, and they even built a bathroom with seawater at her request.
Pumped from Port Phillip Bay, I believe.
Yes, that's right. It is remarkable. So J.C. Williamson's The Company was not just doing musical comedies and pantomimes, but they're also involved in opera as well.
Why is it important to keep the Tallis legacy alive, and what relevance does it have today?
The Tallis legacy is a really wonderful one, a very important one to celebrate. And with John Tallis, the son of Sir George, I think his ambition to maintain Ballura as a house for all Victorians to enjoy, with its extraordinary furniture and theatrical memorabilia, it feels as if John has just left the room. It's a living place, and I think that's wonderful. But also, the Ballura Tallis Foundation, which maintains the property, supports artists. They support people from the ANAM, Australian National Academy of Music, and also the Melba Opera Trust, and other musicians. And it was very important for John to support young musicians, as he was himself.
So how's the upcoming event you created going to capture the imagination of theatre performed 100 years ago?
We're reviving greatest hits, I think you might call it, from in this little mashup idea, from shows that were actually staged in 1916 by J.C. Williamson Limited. Some of those things, like The Merry Widow, of course, are still very well known, but most of them have forgotten, which is a great pity because there's wonderful music and it's a very elegant, charming time. And I'm delighted with my cast and the musicians to try and bring that to life. I think it's very exciting.
How do we get tickets to see this amazing spectacle?
There are three performances. The first will be on Friday, the 19th of August at 6:30. And then the next day, the Saturday, the 20th, there's two performances at 1:30 and also 6:30. And the best way to get tickets is just to ring Ballura Direct. And the phone number there is 5975-2027. And it features musicians from the Melbourne Symphony Orchestra and Orchestra Victoria, and also an excellent pianist by the name of David Ross Smith. So we've got a wonderful little band, which I've called the Palm Court Orchestra. And then there are outstanding performers from the world of opera. It's just going to be a wonderfully elegant performance with some extraordinary costumes. So I think it's quite something to see, I think.
And finally, just a little about Bruce, the creator of 1916.
I'm 47. I'm the same age in 2016 as Sir George was in 1916.
Wow.
Trained at the Victorian College of the Arts. I did the opera course there, and I've had a career in classical music ever since. So I work for Melbourne Opera Trust, which is how I came to know about Ballura, and I run the mentor program here. We train opera singers who are looking to make steps into their professional careers. And I also am a performer still, so I do a couple of professional engagements a year, either concerts or opera performances. Yeah, that's my life story.
Excellent. Well,
very much.
They're in good hands. Join Bruce and his talented musicians for 1916, a concert you'll never forget. And now, the Mornington Peninsula Chorale members have been fine-tuning their vocal cords in readiness for an experience of a lifetime. All 51 of the 100 chorale members aged between mid-40s and 70s have been invited to perform in front of 3,000 distinguished guests at Carnegie Hall, New York, in January 2017. They will join other choristers from around the world to form the Distinguished Concerts Singers International. I on the Peninsula found out more about this venture with convener and senior member Judy McKee. She starts off with the prestigiousness and great privilege it is to be chosen to perform and how it came about.
I got a call from New York, and initially I thought it was a hoax because I didn't believe that somebody from Carnegie Hall would be ringing to ask us to perform there. I then took it to our choir director, Tom Buchanan, who's been looking after us now for about 6 or 7 years, and he thought it was a good idea. And then we presented it to the choir. The choir initially, again, thought it was a joke. And then they began to realise we were quite serious, and they got very, very excited. We had sung some of Carl Jenkins's works previously. Carl Jenkins is a living composer. He's Welsh and is well known, particularly for the Mass for the Armed Man, which we actually sang at the Frankston Arts Centre to celebrate the 100th anniversary of the First World War. We certainly let him know we were doing those performances, and I suspect that that may have been where it came from. What we didn't know then is that he is an in-house conductor at Carnegie Hall. What we had to do was submit an audio that would give them an insight into the quality of our choir, and the response on return was, "We want you over here."
So what's so special about choirs?
But I think the special thing about choirs is the fact that we do have mothers and daughters, husbands and wives, and we have what we call the Wern family singers, who are quite incredible with their knowledge of music.
What does it take to be an exceptional choir?
Discipline, passion, a knowledge of music, not necessarily that you have to be a musician, but it's important that if you have the passion, you practice that music. For ours, it's a little more challenging than some of the other choirs. We sing some fairly technical and difficult music. Some of our music is about fugues, works from Bach, Mozart. You're singing in Latin. In some music, we sing in other languages, anything from African to South American to German, French, and of course, English. So our challenge is to be able to put four voices, at least sometimes 6 to 8 voices together, and make this incredible sound. We have first and second sopranos, first and second altos, first and second tenors, and first and second basses. And we all blend. The way in which that occurs is Tom Buchanan, who is an incredible director of our choir, he's very disciplined. For 2 hours every week, we spend time blending the voices. During the week, we practice our harmonising.
And do you know what songs the choir will be singing?
Yes, we will be singing the Carl Jenkins Requiem, which is a fairly new work. It is quite beautiful. It's very haunting. It's quite special.
This privilege to sing at Carnegie Hall comes at a cost, with all members having to pay their own way. What funds have you raised, and what future plans are in place to raise funds?
We haven't raised a lot of money so far, but we've got a lot of plans underway. There's lots of things going on. One, obviously, is the sausage sizzles. We've got the local Mornington Lions Club that's going to run a barbecue for us as well. We've got an afternoon tea in a Flinders garden. We've got an additional Christmas concert that we're going to have at Sorrento, and that all the money raised from that will contribute towards it. I would say it's fair to say, per person, it's probably $5,000. And when you consider 51 are going, you're looking at $500,000 for us to go over there for 7 days. With the performance, we don't receive any revenue from that. It's up to us to find that money. So for some members of the choir, it'll be a very big saving time for them. Our plan is to try and offset some of those costs, and we'd be delighted to find that we've got enough that it makes a difference to people going to New York.
Other plans?
We've put in for some local government and bigger grants at a Commonwealth level, and we've also got a crowdfunding site, which is the Australian Cultural Fund, Mornington Peninsula Chorale, and we're hoping that people will get online. It would be exciting to think, you know, people would just donate $5 to $10. It would make an enormous difference.
Separate to activities and performances around fundraising for the trip to New York, There's another great performance coming up on the 21st of August.
So we have three major performances a year, and one of those performances is the Proms at the Frankston Arts Centre. We will have 90 of our choristers performing there, and we're hoping that we're going to get a full contingent at the concert. It'll be very exciting to have that. Your tickets can be purchased from the Frankston Arts Centre. You can either ring in or you can go to the box office there.
This is the first time the Monte Peninsula Chorale, in affiliation with the Frankston Music Society, is accompanied by the Frankston Symphony Orchestra. Go to frankstonmusicsociety.org.au. That ends our program for another week. If you have any news on the street you want to share with our team, please contact RPPFM on 5975-1234. Next week, I on the Peninsula will once again bring you up to date with issues that matter to you. We hope you can tune in next Tuesday at noon on 98.7 and 98.3 FM Frankston. You can live stream from our website, rppfm.com.au, and download the RPPFM app. If you miss any Eye on the Peninsula programs, podcasts are available on our website, and check out the Eye on the Peninsula Facebook page. Thank you to all our reporters, including Kiara Rose Kemp, our guests, and community correspondent Kevin Wilcox. Our usual presenter, Piers Cunningham, will be back next week for the latest current affairs and news on the Moranty Peninsula. I'm Deborah Maher. Thank you for your company.